there's a covenant within the United Nations where it says free, prior, and informed consent, yet Canada does not live up to it. And that's, you know, really what they're doing is subverting a lot of international laws as well as their own proclamations, where they stated that they have a fiduciary duty to protect Indigenous people.
Canada, like America, like Europe, like Australia, like Israel, is a huge advocate of human rights when it advances their neoliberal free market agenda. You know, last year Canada went through their periodical UN Human Rights Review, and they scored 8th on the planet in the UN Human Rights Index. But when the committee analyzed Canada's human rights record through its Aboriginal policy and its treatment of Indigenous peoples, Canada scored 48th.
Obviously, Canada has a very deep-rooted relationship to colonialism within Canadian borders. The whole existence of Canada is premised on the dispossession of First Nations peoples and the colonial administration of their communities by the Canadian government via Indian Affairs. But also, even outside Canadian borders, there's a long history of Canadian colonial or imperial practices. For example, the banking industry has a long history in the Caribbean and Latin America. There are mining companies that have relationships to various Central American dictatorships or the dictatorship in Indonesia in the Cold War period. So there's a long history of colonialism, both within and beyond Canada.
It's more than colonialism. It's, you know, killing the spirit of a nationhood, the belief of a nationhood. You know, it's not colonialism anymore. It's too radical. It's too racial, the approach that this federal government is taken, ignoring the First Nation people, you know, who use and occupy the land.
You know, a lot of people don't get educated in school about how Indian reservations were created. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, the South African apartheid system was based on the reservations apartheid system here in Canada. You know, we didn't have these settlements prior to colonization. For example, residential schools, where they took our children away from our parents for 100 years and put them into essentially work camps and beat them for speaking their language and cut their hair. You know, and these schools were magnets for, you know, predators, sexual predators of kids. You know, a lot of the nuns and priests and groundskeepers and whatnot were straight up pedophiles. A lot of our kids, including my own mom and, you know, a lot of my relatives that went, you know, faced severe abuse, sexual, physical abuse when they went to residential school. And I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that Canada is an apartheid country, you know. It still is in very many ways.
Historically, when capitalism emerges in Canada, the focus of the Canadian state vis-a-vis Indigenous peoples was to destroy their Indigenous cultures, their economies, their polities, and so on, and forcefully remove them from the land. And the goal was to gain access to the land and its subsurface minerals and resources. And I would argue that that has been definitive of Canada's relationship with Indigenous peoples ever since to the present day.
The language that is utilized by the Canadian government in dealing with First Nations and talking about their relationship with First Nations globally is the same colonial racist language used by the Zionist government of Israel when talking about Palestinians. It's grounded in the same Eurocentric kind of white patriarchal, you know, kind of power base, that subjugates and looks at, you know, either Palestinian or Indigenous peoples as children, you know, that need to be taken care of as a problem.
The value of our culture, of the land, of the rivers and the lakes, of the practices, of the traditions, is worth so much more than the blood money dollar bills that they keep waving in our faces. Our culture, our lands, our rivers and our waters is more than priceless. It is sacred. sacred, and we aren't going to sell it down the river for a couple of, for a pipeline that will is guaranteed to destroy our livelihood. So I wrote a song, Shallow Waters.
About a future where the land is intoxicated and it's polluted and uninhabitable, and it's sad because, and it's scary because that future is possible if we keep continuing on this industrial road that we're on. It's about a future where the Harper government and industry has turned our lands in BC into a giant Walmart.
Well, we're just wrapping up here. The Yinkadeni Alliance leadership has just come out of the annual general shareholder meeting of Enbridge. They're very clear and concise that there's absolutely no way that this pipeline nor the supertanker traffic that it promises to bring to the West Coast will ever happen. And yeah, we're tired, a little bit wet, but feeling very positive.
No tankers, no pipeline, no tankers.
The earth is coming to its place of fulfillment, I guess, in terms of all of the population, the damage to the water, all of that put together. I think we're coming into a time, I don't know when this is going to happen, but I think we're coming into a time where the earth has to heal itself and it has to renew itself.
Our own Cree Nation has a prophecy, the prophecy of the seventh generation, that speaks of a time when a generation of young people would come up and they would be free from the colonial mind, you know, where they would still understand, you know, the violence of colonization, but they would not be crippled by it, and they would, you know, take action. Our prophecy talks about that, and I believe that that's right now. Right where we are.
I've heard the prophecy where the people have to unite, have to become one to make that change, to change that renewal process.
And while many get depressed or overwhelmed and even apathetic about, you know, things like climate change and, you know, the austerity agenda of these neoconservative maniacs that are running our country, I see a tremendous amount of hope and light emerging in a social movement that is rising up, you know, to combat against the drivers of climate change, to combat against this economic paradigm, and I'm filled with hope.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. And in this program, we try to answer your questions, queries, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, May peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqvi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University, Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. It's an honor.
Professor Naqvi, we have one more audience question today about our Olsons. I have an Olson boy and he is obsessed with the music. How do I deal with this boy?
Of course, the conventional answer would be to say that no, music is haram and we should make him abstain from listening to music. And we should try to reflect his attention and make it go towards other things. Of course, that is correct. But we can't call, we can't say music is haram in essentially every type of music.
All music is not haram.
Music, a melodious tune is music. Recitation of the Holy Quran in a melodical way.
The is husn, another music.
Is a type of music. The
chirping of birds, the sound of water.
Exactly.
That we have been recommended to listen.
When we recite poems or poetry and remember Imam Hussein and we remember the tragedy of Karbala, we recite Noha and we recite Marthiya and the different forms of poetry which is there for the remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, that is also in the form of music. Music is not in its essence inherently forbidden. No, some sorts, sorts of music which lead to a certain state of mind and feelings and thoughts, arouse instincts which are human, animal instincts, or even natural animal sexual feelings are aroused by such music. That is not allowed. Music which is exclusively for places or where people they play around and they make joy and they think make merry and it is in a very negative manner. Such music is forbidden. So actually, we cannot completely cut off the society from music.
Okay.
We need to channelize it in the proper direction. Yes, it does strike a lot of chords in our human, the feelings and the emotions which we have. Certain chords in us are stricken by the music we heard. Even there's music which gives us some sort of
soothing.
Has a soothing effect. So we cannot completely cut off
deny
things. But we need to make sure that our child is not getting engaged in music which is going to become harmful for him, or it is going to make him feel aroused and then cause him to find himself in a difficult situation. So we need him to desist from that. And of course, again, this comes back to giving him alternatives in which he can enjoy himself, leisure time, a positive leisure time, constructive leisure time, engagement with parents, engagement with siblings. And there should be a time kept for positive discussions.
All right.
And expression of feelings and love and compassion for each other and reaching out to each other to help each other, to talk about each other's problems. There should be some sort of alternative. So you cannot ask a child to desist from something which is soothing him,
mm-hmm.
and you're not providing an alternative.
All right.
So that is very important.
All right. We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakafi. We were talking about an adolescent boy who was obsessed to music, and the mother was concerned. Professor Nakavi said that you cannot completely make a child ignore something that is giving him soothing effect. Rather, you could actually guide yourself on what is halal music and what is haram music, and change his direction, change his talent towards, take his talent towards the halal music, and also provide him other alternatives that give him soothing effect and give more leisure time to your child. Thank you, Professor, for this answer. And now we have another question, which says that excessive saying no to things develops least self-confidence. How do I deal with this in case of my children? The age is not mentioned, but it again seems, because self-confidence is something that the teens start developing. And the mother is concerned that since she excessively ignores a child not to do a particular thing, now this has kind of led to a lack of self-confidence. And how does she deal with this?
So again, it comes back to the early ages of childhood, especially in that stage where it has been emphasized in the narrations, also in the hadiths which we have, that the child has to be given freedom at least till the age of 7, where he can express his feelings, where he can scream out, he can play, he is engaged in physical activities, and he feels quite confident of himself that he can carry out things in a bold way. He is not afraid to do, of course, again, that has to be controlled, not to allow him to do things which are dangerous.
Yeah.
But activities, sports, and things which are beneficial, which are not negative. So the more he has develops this sense of confidence from the early ages of his life, and where his feelings and his feelings and his emotions, which he expresses verbally or in the form of playing and actions and behavior, he is not suppressed. He's not told off. He's not scolded for doing something. For example, we think it's outrageous, but it's not. A child starts screaming, no problem, let him scream. It's okay. But if we start scolding him and preventing
him. Or every small thing.
And especially not because it's a wrong thing, but more because it's annoying us.
Yeah.
We may say, we may stop him from something which is going to harm him.
Okay.
No, if he is engaged in something which is dangerous,
we
need to stop him, we need to control him. Initially, we need to, for example, in a place where he's playing or she's playing, we should not allow things to remain which may be, for example, dangerous for him or her. Things which have pointed edges, for example. Or we don't put him in a place where there's the electricity,
the access to electricity
or whatever, that he pokes his finger into it, for example. No, we should manage that environment, that place where he wants to be free. So we need to control that, but allow him to express himself.
Okay.
But if we start scolding him or her because his or her screaming is annoying me,
it's wrong.
That causes him to feel a sort of
lower self-confidence.
He feels or she feels there's a clash.
All right. Professor, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi. Professor Nakavi, you said that how we are behaving with a child when we are actually schooling him continuously and the child has developed least self-confidence, the mother was concerned and she did not mention the age. However, the important thing she mentioned is that she admitted she's scolding her child. And you said if a mother is just scolding just not to get annoyed and not letting her child express himself, it's wrong. It's not right.
It will have a negative impact on the child. The child will feel that my mother or my elder is cares about himself or herself more than me.
More.
He or she does not feel for me. He or she is feeling for herself or himself. So he feels that they're becoming self-centered.
Okay.
So
it has adverse effects.
It has an adverse effect, and the child also becomes self-centered. Then he stops feeling for others. He starts. He feels okay. That serves them right. I'll scream more and make them more annoyed. So that becomes a challenging thing. So we need to desist from that. So the more he has or she has been given freedom at that tender age, the more self-confidence he or she develops. And as a result, at a later age, he or she does not feel, does not feel the fear of the dark, maybe, or does not feel feel scared by going alone outside, or does not feel, for example, talking to a stranger. He or she does not feel a fear of talking to someone who or she or he
does not know.
So, I mean, you find children.
So all these consequences are because of this thing.
This thing. So the confidence has to be developed from early tender ages, and later on, if there's a problem, then you need to find a counselor and to take his or her help to remove this problem, because this will persist, unfortunately, for many years down the lane, even in years when he or she becomes independent. He or she will not have the confidence to engage in activities which are necessary. Even in his or her own marriage, after marriage, he or she may face difficulties because of this issue. So we need to be very careful. We need to, as parents, we need to do a lot of studying. We need to take the advice of many counselors, read into what they're saying, and to prepare ourselves for becoming parents. Parenting is not something very easy. It's a difficult job. It's a very difficult job, and it cannot be done alone. You need two parents to work together in harmony and in unison. So that is a very difficult thing to do. Unfortunately, the problems which we face in society today is because the family unit has not been developed properly. The family unit is the basic unit of society. And in the West, unfortunately, this basic unit has been completely destroyed to an extent.
Yeah.
With single mother families.
Deals all alone with a child.
Or unfortunately, today, gays and lesbians and so many things. Unfortunately, but fortunately, the Islamic society is still intact. The basic unit is there. It has to be controlled and managed.
Yeah. So what we get over here is that your scolding just because you get annoyed is not correct, because this will have consequences in the life of a child, not just throughout his childhood, but also through his adolescence, and also when he gets married, in his married life as well, and in developing relationship with others.
And how he or she manages his or her children in the future.
Yeah, so how he even becomes a parent himself, it will affect everything, just your scolding. So parents, do control yourself. Professor, thank you so much for being with us. Dear listeners, we hope that these discussions are helping you. Give us your feedback on our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Dear listeners, now let's listen to 151st and 2nd verses of chapter Shu'ara.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ
And do not obey the order of the transgressors.
الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا يُصْلِحُونَ
Who cause corruption in the land and do not amend.
So the verse says, وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ And the next one, الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا يُصْلِحُونَ And do not obey the bidding of the extravagant, those who make mischief in the earth and amend not, وَلَا يُصْلِحُونَ So these are how the words of their prophet continued. فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهُ وَأَطِيعُونَ Then be in awe of Allah and obey me after he criticized them. And he continues, وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ Do not obey the bidding of the extravagant, الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ He tries to explain who truly these musrifin are, these extravagant ones, الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ Those who make mischief on the earth, وَلَا يُصْلِحُونَ They do not rectify. They amend not. Of course, we know that extravagance is the same as exceeding the limits of law. Different laws, law of creation, law of religion. And this is also clear for all that in a correct system, any exceeding the limit causes corruption and destruction for other parts. In other words, the origin of corruption is extravagance, and the consequence of extravagance is mischief. Of course, it should be noted that extravagance has a pretty vast meaning. Sometimes it is used in simple issues like eating and drinking. Sometimes it is in judgment and judiciary arbitration, which leads to falsehood. And sometimes it is in one's beliefs, which leads to doubt and skepticism, as it is in chapter Ghafir, where the words Musrif and Murtab have come together. Sometimes it has also been used in the sense of self-superiority, arrogance, and exploitation, as it is used in chapter Dukhan, where the Holy Quran says about Pharaoh, "Surely he was haughty and of the extravagant." And finally, sometimes it has been applied to any sin and fault, as it is used in chapter Zumar, where the Holy Quran says, "Oh, my servants, who have acted extravagantly against their own selves, do not despair of the mercy of Allah. Surely Allah forgives the faults altogether. Surely He is the forgiving, the merciful." لا تقنطوا من رحمة الله إن الله يغفر الذنوب جميعا. So, this is the importance of the meaning of extravagance and its different implications. على مر الزمان تألقا
وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So we explain the meaning of extravagance. Now, the verse says, "La tuti'u amra al-musrifin." Let's have a look at this verse alone. So, in the previous verses, as you were with us, we had a look at what the Prophet Salih told them. At the end, he said, فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ. Now you need to obey me. You need to be in awe of Allah and obey me. And now he says, وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ. These two things must be together. Loving someone in accordance with negating the others. This is exactly as the concept of belief in the Almighty Allah and negating belief in any other thing. لا إله إلا الله, both together. So you need to أطيعون, obey me, and at the same time, لا تطيعوا أمر المسرفين. So anyway, the one who is from among the extravagant ones is not qualified to lead one country or one nation or society, and that's why their prophet tells them لا تطيعوا أمر المسرفين. These people are not qualified to be your leaders. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. There are other points to be discussed regarding these two verses, which we will, God willing, mention in the next episodes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Aperture.
Depression is a mood disorder that causes a persistent feeling of sadness and loss of interest. It affects how you feel, think, and behave, and can lead to a variety of emotional and physical problems. Patients may have trouble doing normal day-to-day activities and could sometimes even feel as if life isn't worth living. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Depression may require long-term treatment with a host of pills, antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, and tranquilizers, but sometimes the cure could be much worse than the ailment. Thousands of documented cases prove that the prescription of such drugs have led to suicide, acts of violence, and even murder. Death by prescription reveals the shocking truth about psychotropic drugs and a healthcare system that perhaps undermines the potential dangers of such medication. Stay with us for this part of the documentary.
Mark was 48 years old when he committed suicide in October 2013. He was suffering from recurring back pain and had had an operation, but the cure was worse than the ailment. It hit him hard, and he was prescribed antidepressants. Mark was the father of two children and had never had suicidal thoughts before, but in less than a week, the medication sent him into madness. His sister Florence has still not recovered from it. Is an antidepressant responsible for the death of Florence's brother? These heartbreaking events are echoed in thousands of documented cases across the world. Psychotropic drugs are under the spotlight. Antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, sleeping pills, and tranquilizers are supposed to stitch together the fragilities of the soul. They save many lives. But can they also lead to suicide or even murder? What are these psychotropic medications that are sometimes held responsible for acts of violence? First off are antidepressants, the grandfather of the new wave being Prozac. This antidepressant is supposed to act upon depressive states, deep sadness, psychic fatigue, and anxiety. It should give a mood boost in order to bring the patient back to a stable condition. In France, it's taken by at least 6 million people. Next, we have the benzodiazepines, with the most widespread examples being anxiolytic drugs such as Valium or Xanax, but also a high number of sleeping pills. They treat states of anxiety, panic attacks, and insomnia. Unlike antidepressants, they bring the mood down to calm the anxiety. It's a bestseller in France. 11.5 million people take it each year. More than one in four adults. Finally, there are various tranquilizers and powerful neuroleptics, which influence the nerves. Nobody disagrees with how useful these medications are, as they act upon serotonin, a neurotransmitter that regulates the mood. But depending on individuals, they can short-circuit the brain, which can be dangerous and even fatal. In France, Professor Evan is one of the only doctors to sound the alarm. He has compiled or translated a handful of reports and studies that warn against psychotropic drugs. At what moment do these medications become dangerous? For benzodiazepines, whose effects are immediate, it's during the first days of the treatment, especially when coming off the medication. For a large number of people, anxiolytics or sleeping pills can be more addictive than heroin, which is why the treatment shouldn't last longer than a few weeks. As for antidepressants, which don't take effect until 2 or 3 weeks of use, murder or suicide can occur during the first few days of treatment, whenever the dosage is increased, or when the medications are stopped. When this happens, a devastating rebound effect can occur that places some patients in a state that they feel compelled to continue. Before taking his life, Florence's brother was right at the beginning of his treatment. In his letter, he speaks of having acid in his body. Are prescriptions given too readily in France? To allow us to find out, we went to 6 randomly chosen medical clinics equipped with a hidden camera. 95% of psychotropic medication is supplied by general practitioners. Our scenario will be simple, going through a rough patch due to losing a job. 5 minutes and 32 seconds was all it took to get a prescription of anxiolytics during the first consultation. The second doctor hands over a prescription of antidepressants, which he confirms have virtually no side effects whatsoever. The third is not strictly in favor of psychotropic medication, but strangely, he still supplies Seroplex, an antidepressant. Only the fourth finds it too early to give a psychotropic medication in such a case. Antihistamines are also used to treat allergies, but they can facilitate sleep. The fifth proposes an anxiolytic. She suggests a half tablet, then a whole, then two, then up to four a day. The prescription lasts 3 months, whereas the recommended limit is 8 weeks due to the extremely addictive effects of Xanax. If that isn't enough, she suggests adding an antidepressant. But the record was beaten by the last doctor, who proposed both an anxiolytic and an antidepressant in only 2 minutes. Everybody's happy, except when psychotropic medication drives somebody mad. Here's a brilliant young girl, Aurélie. 6 years ago, her treatment transformed her into a destructive machine. Aurélie could have died or gone insane. She attempted suicide and was then committed to a psychiatric hospital. 6 years ago, with a master's degree in economics, she found a job in New York. She worked hard, went out often, and was close to burnout. She returned to Paris. Her general practitioner was absent, so she met with a psychiatrist. The peaceful young girl was in a rage, and it worried her. So she consulted other doctors. Aurélie had a strong reaction to the dosage increase. A suicide attempt, followed by a psychiatric hospital. She therefore decides to stop the treatment. The violent urges disappeared immediately, but it would take her 2 years to fully recover. Today, Aurélie has rebuilt her life. She lives in London, where she has become a painter. But she still wants to know what really happened. She therefore meets with a reputed British psychiatrist, David Healy. For the pharmaceutical industry, this man is a menace. For years, he has denounced psychotropic medication as dangerous, and his expertise has led to major criticism for the leading laboratories. He claims that these pills are useful but dangerous.
Well, first of all, the pills can be helpful. I use these pills to treat people, but they don't suit everyone. And when they don't suit you, they can definitely be poisonous. They can make you want to kill yourself. They can make you want to kill other people. And they can generally cause you to hear voices and become crazy.
Yeah.
There's certainly about one in 20 people who go on the pills, at least, have what you could call an extreme reaction to them. So that's actually fairly common, okay? Roughly half of the people that go on these pills, they just aren't suited to them. They have a bad reaction, but they don't have an extreme reaction.
If someone has a side effect of the medication, they can say, listen, it's because you had a depression at the beginning, that's why you were like this. So they make you feel that it's because of your first date that you feel so bad. It's not because of the medication.
And this is the problem. This is where things really go wrong, where once you've been put on the pills, doctors don't recognize when they have made things worse. What they say is it's down to doctors. We make the pills, it's down to doctors to use them wisely. If things go wrong, it's the doctor's fault, okay, not ours. Mm. Now, the pharmaceutical industry have as much control of the situation as the Soviet Union used to have during the 1960s.
Aurélie comes out of the interview with the impression that she was the victim of a medical error. She thinks about her psychiatrist with a heavy heart. So she will meet up with her 6 years later to finally turn the page. The psychiatrist concedes an error in the diagnosis, but the whole system leads to an increase of psychotropic consumption. It's in the interest of pharmaceutical companies to have a high number of ill people, as psychotropic medication represents a global market of tens of billions of dollars. As the number one user in the world of such medication, France is a true cash register. These happiness pills are making the pharmaceutical companies smile. Their profits exceed those of the petroleum companies. In the United States, this exaggerated medicalization has a particular resonance. As the years went by, unexplained suicides by children taking antidepressants or anxiolytics hit the public opinion. Here, a 10-year-old child is phoning the emergency services. His 14-year-old sister has attempted suicide, having been on Paxil for just a few days, an antidepressant known in France under the name of Seroxat.
This is 911. Who is this? Where is your sister? What is she trying to do? Take pills?
What? No, my dad's home now.
Hold on, tell me!
GSK, the laboratory that manufactures Paxil, managed to conceal explosive studies conducted by its own experts. Following a court trial, the authorities obliged GSK to reveal the studies. They showed that the medication increased suicidal thoughts or acts by up to 8 times. Massacres perpetrated by teenagers should also be mentioned. 9 out of 10 killers were on a cocktail of psychotropic medication. Despite thousands of people that call for action against the pharmaceutical companies, psychotropic medication remains a bestseller in the U.S. and its business as usual. Every year, the powerful American Psychiatric Association organizes the most important symposium on the planet. Over 5 days, 15,000 psychiatrists from across the globe attend several conferences. The pharmaceutical industry struck gold. It largely finances the event by promoting its latest medications, and the stands invade an entire hall. For the occasion, even the Vice President of the USA, Joe Biden, is here. This reflects the importance of the event. Leading the American Psychiatric Association is Jeffrey Lieberman, certainly the most influential psychiatrist on the planet. During the press conference, we asked him questions regarding the dangers of psychotropic medication.
These are not dangerous drugs by and large, or certainly no more dangerous than those which are used routinely for other non-psychiatric types of disorders. The side effects should never be a deterrent for somebody who genuinely suffers from depression getting treatment.
This is a disease, a brain disorder, with about a 5% mortality rate.
Depression is a disorder where you cannot experience emotion because you feel dead inside. You feel hopeless, helpless, and you would be dead, but you probably don't have the wherewithal to figure out how to commit suicide.
A lot of the over-exaggeration about fears of side effects and are promulgated by people who either don't know or don't want to know, and they foment this.
Is Jeffrey Lieberman best positioned to answer about this medication? The list of pharmaceutical companies that finance him is infinite. We can better understand why Jeffrey Lieberman doesn't much like party poopers, the hundreds of protesters who regularly come to disturb the great gathering of psychiatry. This includes a multitude of associations, as well as the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is run by Scientologists. Today's slogan, Stop Drugging Our Soldiers. A wave of unexpected suicides effectively shook the U.S. Army. And the protesters blame the antidepressants that are administered in 9 out of 10 cases.
22 U.S. veterans are committing suicide every single day. There are more active duty military dying from suicide in 2012 than on the battlefield. There are 49 international drug regulatory warnings on antidepressants that caution against aggression, mania, suicide, in some cases homicidal ideation. It's outrageous. So it's not as if the psychiatrists don't know.
Faced with the protesters, the mainly foreign psychiatrists are somewhat skeptical.
I just discussed a little with them was that there seems to be sometimes it's different or difficult to know if there's a causative relationship. If you have a progression in the disease and you are medicated too, is it the medication or is it the disease itself?
I read stories that quite a few veterans committed suicide last year, but I was wondering how many suicides have been prevented by taking antidepressants. So I suppose you can't cure everything with just taking a pill. You should give the psychotherapy as well, but I'm not sure if the antidepressants are only responsible for the increased suicide rate.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. The great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
All right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question.
Okay.
Well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
These ads banned in France reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed. For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer.
Thank you.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very important question. That question is about, it's connected with the problem of intercession. This is about the people who will be deprived of intercession in the hereafter. You know, intercession is something that all human beings will need on in the hereafter. A man called Abu Ayman once came to Imam Baqir saying, "Oh Abu Ja'far, you delude people by saying Muhammad's intercession will help you. Muhammad's intercession." At this time, the Imam got so angry that his face was glowering and said, "Woe betide you, O Abu Ayman, if your belly and your private parts keep you away from sin, does that mean they delude you? You would only have to see the atrocities of the Day of Resurrection to need Muhammad's intercession. Woe unto you! In any case, do you think that he will only intercede for those whose punishment in the fire is obligatory?" Then he continued saying, "Every single person, from the first to the last, will need the intercession of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam on the Day of Resurrection." So intercession is something that all human beings will need on the Day of Resurrection. So it's something imperative. So if somebody is deprived of it, it's a great misfortune for that person. Who are the people who will be deprived of the Prophet's intercession? Fortunately, we have this answer in the form of some hadith, which we will recite for you here today. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Two types of people will not be included in my intercession." Who are those? They are the tyrannical and iniquitous ruler and the heretical extremists in matters of religion. Ghalin fid din, a person who goes to extremes in matters of religion.